From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
Malcolm lives in Inglewood, California, in the Darby Dixon neighborhood referred to as the Bottom. Malcolm's friends, Jib and Diggy, are also geeks.
The new comedy, Dope, is about an African-American teenager and his friends who love 90s hip-hop, punk rock, and Japanese comics. Today, we talk with the director and screenwriter, Rick Famuyiwa. Also, author Matt Johnson tells us about his new novel, Loving Day. The main character, like Johnson, is biracial, but often is mistaken for white.
I look like a pale Puerto Rican. I look like a really ragged ex-Latvian rugby player. You know, I've dealt with the conflict my whole life between how I look and my actual ethnic and racial identity.
And as TV critic, I'll discuss why some of the best news coverage is coming from late-night comedians. In a personal essay called Proving My Blackness, our first guest, Matt Johnson, wrote, "I grew up a black boy who looked like a white one. His African-American mother and Irish-American father divorced when he was 4. He says, I was raised mostly by my black mom in a black neighborhood of Philadelphia during the Black Power movement. So there was quite a contrast between how he saw himself and how others saw him. Race and identity also are themes of his novel Pym and his graphic novel Incognigro. The main character in Johnson's new satirical novel, Loving Day, is a comic book artist who, like Matt Johnson, is biracial, but to many people looks white. When the novel opens, he's newly divorced and has just returned to Germantown, the Philadelphia neighborhood where he grew up. Matt Johnson spoke with Terry last Monday.
Matt Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd love to start with a reading. So this reading happens when the main character is at a small comic book convention and he finds himself placed on the panel of African-American comic book authors. And he knows because he looks white that people will assume, like, what is he doing there? And in fact, somebody asks, like, what are you doing on this panel? And if you could pick it up from there.
Why am I at the black table? I'm a local writer just back in town, you know, peddling my wares, I tell them, then babble on a bit more, eventually get into my name and the last book I worked on. The words don't really matter. What I'm really doing is letting my black voice come out to compensate for my ambiguous appearance. Let the bass take over my tongue. Let the south of my mom's ancestry inform the rhythm of my words in a way few white men could pull off. It's conscious, but not unnatural. I sometimes revert to this native tongue even when I have nothing to prove, often when I've been drinking. I refer to my last graphic novel with the pronoun John. I finish what I'm saying with, know what I'm saying? He nods at me a little, slightly appeased, because he does know what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I'm black too. What I'm saying is that he can relax around me because I'm on his side. That he doesn't have to worry I'm going to make some random racist statement that will stab him when he's unguarded or be offended when he makes some racist comment of his own. People aren't social. They're tribal. Race doesn't exist, but tribes are effing real. What am I saying? I'm on Team Blackie. And I can see in the slight relaxing that he's willing to accept my self-definition, at least tentatively, pending further investigation.
And that's Matt Johnson reading from his new book, Loving Day. So why don't you describe how you look and how your character looks?
I like to say I look white. And partly the reason I like to say it is as soon as I say it, 20 people point out, actually, no, you don't. So I look like a pale Puerto Rican. I look like a really ragged ex-Latvian rugby player. I've been told I look Egyptian. I've been told a lot of things, but really what I look is ambiguous. You know, I have skin the same color as most or many white people. I have an African nose. I have high cheekbones. For some reason, people always assign high cheekbones to some ethnicity, but apparently by their regards, everybody on earth has high cheekbones, so I don't know if that matters. But I look white to a lot of people, and I'm not. I'm African-American. I'm mixed. I like to call myself a mulatto because that definition fits. So, you know, I've dealt with the conflict my whole life between how I look and my actual ethnic and racial identity.
You're a big man, too. You're, what, 6'4" and about 225 pounds?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you add all this. You can add on to the fact that I'm huge. Yeah, I'm 6'4". It says 225 in the book, but, you know, this is a novel, so I got to cut off some pounds there. But, yeah, so that's part of the whole presentation.
So in the passage that you just read, the character is using his, like, southern, deeper, blacker voice to compensate for the fact that he knows some people think that he looks white and therefore is white. How many languages do you think of yourself as speaking?
Yeah, within English, you know, I speak a lot of them. I keep coming back to this idea of tribes. And, you know, I speak like my mother, you know, who is Midwestern African-American. I speak like my neighborhood in Philly, in Germantown mostly, African-American section of Philly. But I also speak, you know, the way my father speaks when I'm at his house. And that's as an Irish-American in Philly. And, you know, and then I also have my nerd and other tribes as well. So I code switch, which almost everyone does. You know, you code switch between the way you talk with your friends and the way you talk with your grandmother. But my code switching has been because I've traveled in worlds that were fairly different.
So we'll get back to being biracial, both you as a person and the character in your book. But the character in your book returns to Philadelphia at the very beginning of the book, to the neighborhood of Germantown where he grew up, to take over a dilapidated old mansion that his father bought as this, like, giant-sized fixer-upper that he never fixed up. The father has died, so this is his legacy to his son. There's no roof over this mansion.
Right.
It's just, like, you know, walls and interior. So he sleeps in a... You know, the main character ends up sleeping in a tent in this dilapidated mansion. So what were you thinking of in terms of a building or a mansion in the neighborhood where you grew up that made you think of this for the book?
Yeah, there's an actual building, Loudoun Mansion, which is in Philadelphia on Germantown Avenue, right past Wayne Junction, the same place it is in the book. And I used to grow up walking around in that area and seeing that. But really, it's just the Germantown section of Philly, which has this kind of amazing history. At one point, it was its own town separate from the city. And at that time, it had these huge grand mansions because it was a, you know, country resort area. And then slowly it became incorporated into the city. And by the time I got there, it was a majority black working class area that was filled with these huge mansions that were left over by a white upper class that had long since abandoned the entire place. So a lot of them were cut up into multiple apartments. Every once in a while, there'd be some kooky guy living in this, you know, 5,000 square feet, you know, 200-year-old house that with a lot of cats and things like that. And the crazy thing was when I started writing this book, I actually was writing about Germantown and I was trying to figure out why am I stuck on Germantown? Because I haven't lived there in a long time. You know, I still have family there, but I'm not there. And I realized that it wasn't just my connection to where I grew up. It was also that Germantown was a physical representation of my ethnic identity. And this contrast between European culture and African culture, and this contrast between wealth and poverty, and this overwhelming weight of history. You know, I'm in Houston now. Like, you know, a house looks at you wrong in Houston, it's a parking lot the next day. You know, in Philly, it doesn't matter how wretched a house is, chances are it's going to be there forever because we just don't think like that. We just fix up these houses and they stay there forever. But you're constantly steeped in history in Philly. And I started to appreciate that more and more as I got older and realized how much that actually affected, you know, the way I looked at myself.
So your character returns to Philadelphia, to the Germantown neighborhood where he grew up, after having lived in Wales, and he returns because his father's died and he's taking over his father's dilapidated mansion. And so when he gets to Germantown, it's just like this whole different culture that he's been away from for so long. And there's a description in there of getting out of the taxi when he first arrives back in the neighborhood and, you know, getting onto the street. Would you read that for us?
Sure. Welcome home. There are blocks around here where you can be attacked for looking another man in the eyes. And other blocks where you can be assaulted for not giving the respect of eye contact. I can never figure it out. which blocks were which, until I realized these were just the excuses of sociopaths. The sociopaths, that's the real problem. The whole street demeanor is about pretending to be a sociopath as well, so that the real ones can't find you.
I love that paragraph because I think so many of us have gone through this of not knowing when you're supposed to make eye contact, when is that a sign of respect, and when is it a sign of disrespect, and it gets confusing and scary, actually.
Oh, totally. And it's like when I lived in Alaska briefly, it was like a bear attack. You know, you get the advice from people, how do you deal with bears? Well, you just lay down and you just play dead. And the next person would be like, you raise your arms in the air. You know, the next one's like, your only chance is to run. You know, the problem is not that there's some secret for how to deal with it. The problem is that bears eat people, you know? And I think like within that world, you know, I was always worried about that, especially like looking different. In any situation, when you stand out as looking different, you immediately visually tell people that you might not know where you are. You might not have the ability to fight back, and you might be generally disoriented. So, you know, I was always kind of compensating for that. Now, everyone was. Like all my nerd friends, you saw them on the street. They looked like, you know, the roughest guys you ever saw in your life. Then you go to their house and their rooms would be covered with Princess Leia posters, right? But like on the street, everybody was like pretending to be that way. And the real situation is the larger society and, you know, how we are going to negotiate in a way where we're not going to get, you know, mugged.
Your character, your main character, finds out once he returns to Germantown, Philadelphia, that he has a teenage daughter. It turns out that when he was a sophomore in high school, he had a one or a two-night stand with a teenager who he didn't realize was only 14 at the time. And it turns out that she was pregnant and kept the baby, and this now teenage girl approaches him. And I'm wondering if this plot point connects at all with your life. Did you ever worry about that? Yeah. Maybe you had a child out there who you didn't know about?
Yeah. When I started the book and I started figuring out what it was about, I already started thinking about this moment when I was 16 and I had a pregnancy scare with a girl for one of the first, you know, probably the first girl I was with. And it changed my entire life. You know, I was a gregarious, probably good-looking kid, and all I did was run around Center City, Philly on my skateboard. And then I would lie to my parents and say, you know, I'm going to my dad's house to my mom, and I'm going to my mom's house to my dad, and I'd stay out as long as I could. Invariably, I get caught, but, you know, for a while it'd work. And then, you know, I was kind of living this wild life, and it all smacked into me when I realized this might have happened. Then later, you know, it was pretty clear it probably wasn't true and it was being used for other reasons. But it didn't matter because as far as I was concerned, I had learned that I was not emotionally prepared to be sexually active. And I started changing the way I lived and changing the way I looked at women and changing the way I looked at myself. And for the next couple of years, I pulled into this bubble. And I started becoming an introvert. And that's when I started reading. And I always read comic books, but then I figured out for the dollar you spend on a comic, you could buy a whole novel. So I would start getting into novels. And then I read things, you know, first science fiction and then things like Joseph Heller's Catch-22 and Morrison's Beloved and Souls of Black Folk. And this whole world opened up to me. And so I've thought about it since, and I wanted to negotiate what would have happened if my life had been very different.
You wrote a novel that was written in graphic novel form. You had an artist collaborating with you on it called Incognegro, and it's set in the 1930s, and it's about a light-skinned African-American who goes undercover as a white man in the South to investigate lynchings. Did you ever feel in your own life like you were almost operating undercover when you were in, like, white neighborhoods or, you know, white, predominantly white places?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Incognegro came out of me and my cousin Ben running through Mount Airy, imagining that we were, you know, part of the Underground Railroad where we, you know, were secret agents pretending to be white so that we could help people escape from slavery. And we were about 10, I think, when we were doing that. But yeah, I mean, there's points now. I mean, I don't actively try to pass, but I know my privilege. you know, all this stuff, like me, like dealing with the issues I had of the looking the way I did. I mean, they're nothing compared to issues that many African Americans have to deal with in this country. You know, I got pulled over by the cops on the way to this interview.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was completely my fault. I didn't update my tags on my car. It was no biggie. It was no drunken, you know, car chase. But it was still, you know, it's always scary, you know. And when that cop came to the window, I did my best Caucasian. You know, my grammar was perfect. I did everything I could in that moment to be non-threatening. And I know part of that is not, you know, having him perceive me as black, because I know that can end up getting me killed. It can.
Was the cop
so
white?
I didn't know at first, and I was nervous. And he came by, and he was Latino, and I gave a half sigh of relief. You never know. You know, I can't see into anybody's head. But I live with that fear despite the way I look. I mean, when I was home, I get pulled over, but I don't think it was for driving while black. I think it was for driving while appearing Puerto Rican. I don't know what the acronym for that is. But there are times where I've had to do that. And I know I've had privilege because of the way I look.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Matt Johnson, and his new novel is called Loving Day. And Loving Day is a reference to an actual day of celebration. You want to describe what Loving Day is?
Loving Day is a recent holiday that celebrates Loving versus State of Virginia, which federally legalized interracial marriage throughout the country. It started by a guy named Ken Tanabe. He basically just came up with the first idea for it and promoted it, and now people are doing their own Loving Day celebrations across the country. And you'll find people there from, you know, interracial relationships. You are there kind of, you know, meeting up with other people who have dealt with the same issues. And then you find a lot of people of mixed ancestry there. And I didn't know about any of this till I started getting into this world. But that was later.
So when you say this world, like there's like a world, like there's a biracial world.
Oh, yeah. It's a separate planet. it's an ice giant. But yeah, a couple of years ago, I was at this event, right? And I got this vibe from somebody who I really felt like it was a black event. And I felt like they wanted me to basically compensate for how I looked. Like they wanted to know if I was down, you know. I've gotten that vibe, you know, my whole life at different points. So I recognize the vibe. And I was just like, you know, I'm too old for this. And I just didn't do it. And they kept giving me chances to be like, oh, okay. Like questions like, oh, you know, so where'd your wife go to school? Like questions, they were trying to feel me out. And I wouldn't do it. And so afterwards, I went to this lounge area and there was a bunch of other, you know, black people there. And I talked about it. And all these other people started clicking in and saying, you know, I've had that too. Oh, God, I hate that. I hate that. And then at one point, there's about 12 of us. The weird thing was I looked around and realized every one of us was mixed. And we were all identifying something that happens to a lot of black people, but happens even more so to mixed people. And that got me on this idea of community. Because almost everything that's been written about mixed experience usually is about the individual. Like, in, you know, the archetype of the tragic mulatto, like the early novels about mixed identity, they're all about one person. So I really started getting interested both in Loving Day, but also in this larger world about what the community of mixed people were. And so I started going to these events to see what, you know, community mixed experience was like.
And?
It turns out they're just people like everybody else. So everybody just gets on my nerves after like 10 minutes, you know. my one of my big struggles, like a lot of writers have this thing between being an introvert and an extrovert. You know, and I have that, and I have this, like, this feeling of the individual. I'm interested in the individual, but I also get lonely and want my tribes. But invariably, you know, we all seem to get on each other's nerves, and then we, you know, disappear and become the individual again. So, you know, I enjoyed, like, seeing all these other people and interacting with people with this similar issue. But at the same time, I'm really suspicious of groups. Like, I'm really suspicious of anybody who comes in and says, this is your identity now, or this is your belief system. And now that you have this, everything's going to be great. Because, you know, initially it does feel great when you make these adjustments and you have this idea of euphoric connection to this new possibilities about yourself. But after a while, the actual regular suffering of human existence still kicks in.
You know, we've spent so much time during this interview talking about your experiences being of mixed ancestry, you know, your mother black, your father white, your skin color looking, you know, very light, and some people mistakenly assuming that you are just white. And I'm just thinking, hearing you talk, how exhausting that must be to always feel like people are waiting for you to explain yourself, to explain like who you are, that like just being isn't good enough. Like you have to choose a team. You have to explain why you look the way you do. You have to explain that so people accept you. You have to explain that so that you don't get beaten up by the, by the wrong people. Yeah. You have to explain that so that you can be on certain panel discussions or not be on certain panel discussions.
Yeah.
It sounds just utterly exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks. I mean, there's worse identity issues to have, but it just sucks. I mean, you know, one of the things, like when I did this comic Incognito, right? You know, it's about this guy who pretends to be white to investigate lynchings, but it's loosely based on Walter White. But once I did it, I would show up at the bookstore and I noticed they weren't looking at me funny anymore. You know, my first two novels were, you know, marketed just as African-American novels. And then I'd show up and they'd be like, okay, are you the driver? You know? And all of a sudden people saw me, you know, like they saw me. I didn't have to explain anything. So I was just like, whoa, this might be something to further investigate. And I did think, like, in part with Loving Day, I am tired of talking about this. It really feels like I'm walking around all day with ink stain in my breast pocket. You know, that ink stain might be 4 years old, but every time I walk down the hall, somebody's like, hey, you know, you got an ink stain in your pocket. It's unbelievably exhausting. So part of this for me, like I gave my first reading last night and I told them, like, this book is being born today. But for me, it's the funeral for this book. And it's the funeral for having to talk about these issues. Like, I needed to say them. I needed to get them all out on paper. But I don't need to keep them with me forever. I want to put them in the pages of the book, close the book, and keep it at your local library where I don't have to carry this stuff anymore.
Matt Johnson, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
Matt Johnson spoke with Terry last Monday. Johnson is the author of the new satirical novel, Loving Day. The last few weeks have been an amazingly busy news cycle, with a mass shooting at a South Carolina church, landmark Supreme Court decisions being handed down, and more presidential hopefuls announcing their candidacies. I've learned a lot in both tone and substance from TV's cable comedy shows, the ones hosted by Comedy Central's Jon Stewart and Larry Wilmore, and by HBO's John Oliver and Bill Maher.
Yes, what a week, huh? The Confederate flags are coming down and the rainbow flags are going up.
That was the opening of last Friday's Real Time with Bill Maher, when the host comically summarized recent events. Calls for the Confederate flag to be removed from prominence in the wake of the South Carolina killings, and a Supreme Court ruling supporting marriage equality in all 50 states. It was one of the court's rulings. Support of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, was another, that had some conservatives questioning not only those decisions, but the Supreme Court itself. On The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, here's news footage of remarks by Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, followed by Jon Stewart's incredulous reaction.
And what a crazy system to have the most important issues of our day decided by unelected lawyers.
Five unelected black-robed lawyers rule. That is not the America that our founding fathers created.
Then why did they put that article in the Constitution?
What impresses me so much about these shows, by Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, and by Stewart protégés John Oliver and Larry Wilmore, is not just that they proudly present a point of view in an entertaining way. Most of them also make room for a deeper and more honest discussion than you'll find on the Sunday morning public affairs shows. And in addition to keeping the television news outlets honest by checking, questioning, and often ridiculing their remarks, they do the same for the newsmakers themselves. Here's John Oliver last Sunday.
This landmark decision inevitably drew a dissent from Antonin Scalia, a pizzeria chef statue that came to life but never acquired human emotions or empathy. And Scalia was emphatic in his response to Roberts.
His opinion sparked a blistering dissent by Justice Antonin Scalia, who took the unusual step of summarizing it from the bench, calling the court's reasoning absurd, interpretive jiggery-pokery, and pure applesauce.
I'm sorry. Jiggery-pokery? Pure applesauce? Are you a justice or a Victorian dowager writing an angry letter to Prim and Proper Ladies Monthly magazine? Listen, Scalia. Let me answer you in terms that I think you'll understand. Because, yes, the court's ruling was a bit frippity-frappity, but... but I say this, if it takes a touch of goofery and baba ganoush to help people... to help keep the people of this great nation healthy, well, then, by hiblet or by giblet, bring on the hoople and zizzle-zazzle, because that's the kind of country I want to live in. I said good day, sir! Blueberries! Blueberries and custard, sir!
Another prominently divisive issue in the news recently, of course, is the Confederate flag. And Larry Wilmore, who's The Nightly Show had its strongest week ever in terms of content, threw in his two cents without any hesitation or any equivocation.
For the record, the Confederate flag is not a proud symbol of tradition or heritage. It's a symbol of oppression and intimidation. That's not my opinion. That's an objective fact. On March 21st, 1861, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, stated that the Confederate government was based on the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. That speech is now called the Cornerstone Speech because that idea is the cornerstone of the Confederacy. You don't get clearer than that. Now, some people say that Southern states should fly the Confederate flag because it's a symbol of their heritage. But if we flew every flag from our past, why aren't we flying the Union Jack in front of the White House? Right? And for the record, South Carolina, you don't get to make the heritage argument because the Stars and Bars hasn't been flying over the state house since the Civil War. It went up in 1961 to mark the centennial of the Civil War. And coincidentally, right around when the black people started with the wanting of the civil rights. In 1961, it was a reminder to black people that they should know their place. It has always been used as a symbol of intimidation and terror. And that's what it remains today. In fact, because displaying the swastika is illegal across much of Europe, skinheads and neo-Nazis often adopt the Confederate flag in its place.
Yes, they do.
It's such a racist symbol that it does double duty as the backup racist symbol for another racist symbol. That's crazy.
On the regular news outlets, there was lots of discussion about whether the killer in South Carolina was motivated by hatred of race or religion. On this point, too, Wilmore was quite clear, to the point of being blunt.
I know because this was in a church that it's hard to understand this was about race, but let me give you an example. Four black girls were murdered in a church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, all right? Back then, no one pretended to wonder what the motivation was. If you tried to say it was about religion, even the perpetrators back then would have corrected you, all right? No, we killed them because they're Negroes. That's why we did it.
And in one of his roundtable discussion segments, Wilmore put the whole discussion of race and racism in a memorable conversational context.
You've heard this term, Columbusing. You guys ever mm-hmm. heard this term?
I have heard of it.
It means like when white people discover something that everybody else already knew.
Like America. Columbusing. Yes.
Like, I feel like this whole church, this horrific church thing, mm-hmm. has allowed white people to Columbus the fact that racism is still going on. Like in the 60s, in the civil rights era of the 60s, when a lot of these things that were happening to black people was put on television, mm-hmm. white people got to Columbus that. You know, it's right. Like, oh, racism is happening. Yeah, it's been happening for a long time, but thank God for...
Television is allowing us to discover things around us and look at them in new ways all the time. But while in the 1950s and 60s, it was the broadcast evening news shows that helped us to discover the atrocities of racism and the Vietnam War, today we're just as likely to learn and to be moved by going to more unlikely sources. President Barack Obama visits Mark Maron's podcast and talks bluntly about race. On BBC America, Obama invites TV Nature host David Attenborough to the White House to hear Attenborough's ideas about what humans have done to the planet. That's all politics, too, and there's reason to question the motives for these conversations as well as to listen to the content. which, in a wider context, is precisely what these cable comedians are doing. It's a very public service and a very valuable one. Even with all the punchlines, we can all benefit from a little Columbusing. That's what's up. The new movie comedy Dope is about three high school students of color who were obsessed with 90s hip-hop, have their own punk band, and are smart. That makes them the targets of mockery and worse in their predominantly black high school in a poor and working-class section of Inglewood, California. After a party that ends in a shootout, the main character grabs his backpack and finds that someone has put bags of drugs and a gun in it. He and his two friends have to figure out what to do with the drugs without getting killed or imprisoned. Pharrell Williams wrote several new songs for the movie. Our next guest is the film's writer and director, Rick Famuyiwa. He grew up in Inglewood, the son of Nigerian immigrants. He also directed the films The Wood and Brown Sugar, co-wrote Talk to Me, and is now directing an HBO movie about Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Terry spoke with Famuyiwa last Wednesday and began with a scene from Dope. The main character, Malcolm, played by Shameik Moore, is applying to Harvard. He's talking with his guidance counselor about his college admission personal essay, which is titled, A Research Thesis to Discover Ice Cube's Good Day. The guidance counselor, played by Bruce Beatty, speaks first.
Malcolm, when I see stuff like this personal essay, I think you're not taking the process seriously.
I'm taking it seriously, Mr. Bailey, I promise. I'm talking about something that I love. I mean, it's well-reasoned, supported with historical data. It shows creativity, critical thinking. If Neil deGrasse Tyson was writing about Ice Cube, this is what it would look like.
I suggest you go in a different direction. Write something personal about you, your family, your life.
Yeah, I could write about the typical, I'm from a poor, crime-filled neighborhood, raised by a single mother, don't know my dad, blah, blah.
It's cliche.
This is creative. This shows that I'm different. This is the kind of essay that Harvard wants from their students.
Malcolm, I'm gonna be honest with you. You're pretty damn arrogant. You think you're gonna get into Harvard? Who do you think you are? You go to high school in Inglewood. To the admissions committee, your straight A's, they don't mean shit. If you're really serious about this exercise, you're not just wasting my time or yours. Then it's going to be about your personal statement.
Rick Famuyiwa, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film. The essay that Malcolm writes is also a way of showing I'm different. You know, and part of what pop culture means when you're a teenager, the music you love, the movies you love, is it's a way of defining who you are. And I think you've really captured that with this film, how pop culture has like two purposes in young people's lives, just loving it, but also saying, that's who I am.
Yeah. I mean, that's so much of how we define ourselves. And I think in particularly with young kids like Malcolm who don't have a lot of positive influences, pop culture almost becomes a larger part of that self-discovery and how you define yourself.
Is part of why your character of Malcolm is into 90s pop culture because that's the hip-hop that you grew up with, 90s hip-hop?
Yeah, I mean, I could selfishly say that that's, that's the case. I was in high school and college as hip-hop was really sort of coming into its own as a, you know, creative force, as a sort of cultural voice. And it really spoke to me. That era in the late 80s through the 90s was really when the music was so new, fresh, energetic, but still creative. It hadn't quite gotten corporatized yet. And there was just a lot of exciting things happening. But it's interesting because a lot of young kids of this generation, sort of the millennials, for lack of a better term, I think reference both in terms of, you know, musical artists that are out now like Kendrick Lamar and A$AP Rocky who reference 90s sort of style, culture, bravado, and comment and flip those sort of ideas into sort of their new point of view. And so I felt like Malcolm is sort of similar to a lot of those young artists in that way.
So your movie is deep into hip-hop culture, but the heroes in your movie, they're the geeks, not the gangsters. They're the smart kids who have a band. They're immersed in movies and in music. They know their way around computers. The main character wants to get into Harvard, and he's really smart, and you're rooting for him that he's going to make it into Harvard. Was that part of what you wanted to do, to make a story where there's a young African-American as the main character? It celebrates hip-hop, but it's about being smart. It's not about being a gangster.
Yeah, I did. And when I was thinking about Dope and sort of the story that I wanted to tell, I was thinking about a lot of the films that influenced me, especially when I was in film school, and really deciding that this is what I wanted to do for a living, films like Menace to Society and Boys in the Hood, but also films like Bottle Rocket and Boogie Nights, and that took me on different journeys as well. And so the idea was that there could be a sort of different sort of idea about black masculinity. And so the idea was to sort of tell a story about the kids that not only live in this environment, but live in different environments around the country and the world, that sort of have a different point of view, that don't quite fit into sort of the societal norms of what people expect. And so the celebration of these kids who are geeks, who are into a lot of different things, but don't necessarily fit into sort of the accepted or sort of pop cultural norms, was something that I was thinking about doing more just on sort of a personal level, in that I felt like I was that kid. I was like Malcolm. I was the kid who, you know, had these sort of ambitions and oftentimes had people questioning those ambitions. And so I really wanted to just give voice to that.
So when you say people questioned your ambitions, do you mean they beat you up? I mean, I want to quote,
no.
I want to quote a line from the voiceover narration in Dope. Mm-hmm. And it's like, for most geeks, the worst at school is being beaten up by the jocks. But in my neighborhood, it might be getting shot. So what were the black masculinity issues that you faced when you were in high school, and what kind of reaction did you get to your way of being a young man?
No, I mean, I never got beat up, but there is sort of, I guess there's always sort of a social shaming that goes on with adolescence, no matter what that is and where you're from. And the first clip that you played, where Malcolm is talking about his college application and he's dealing with his counselor, who basically asks him, who do you think you are for wanting to do this, to apply to Harvard? I had that similar type of experience where I had a teacher that I was very fond of tell my mother that, you know, I was arrogant because I had these ambitions to want to go to an Ivy League school and do certain things. And his point of view was that position made the other students in the class feel inferior, or when I would answer questions that people didn't know the answer to, that would sort of make everybody feel bad. And so I always thought about that exchange. And of course, my mother sort of, you know, went off on him and told him he was crazy. But I always thought about that because it sort of sat with me, you know, as a young kid hearing that, especially coming from a teacher that you really were sort of fond of, and how that sort of shapes your ambition.
So you mentioned the issue of masculinity and how it's defined for young black men. Mm-hmm. What did you feel defined masculinity when you were in high school, and how did that compare with your own self-image?
I think there's a certain expectation from the outside world about who you are, and you're always aware of that, whether it's growing up in L.A. during the 90s when there were just really a lot of tension between the police and sort of the communities that they often had to police, and having sort of those feelings and being aware of how people perceive you, whether it's going into a store or whether it's driving home from a party with your friends, and knowing that if a policeman pulls you over, how they think of you and what you have to sort of do in your own mind to prepare for that. And so I think there's always a self-awareness of how you're perceived to the world, because it's often something you have to deal with in sort of real world situations.
That leads to something that comes up in at least two of your movies. The Wood, which is an early film of yours, that's set in the neighborhood you grew up in, Inglewood, and your new movie, Dope. In both of them, the main characters have to be careful, because if they accidentally start or intentionally start hanging around with like the wrong people, then they could easily end up in jail, because you never know, or maybe you do know, like who's carrying a gun or who's carrying drugs and who's just, you know, pulled off, you know, a crime of one sort or another. And if you inadvertently get pulled into that group of people, your life as you know it, as you wanted it, can be over. And I'm wondering if you faced that kind of threat to your future when you were growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that you're constantly dealing with. I mean, and in my case, Inglewood is sort of a microcosm of the larger Los Angeles. So there, it has its very affluent parts, and it also has its very sort of economically challenged and struggling parts, and everything in between. And so I sort of lived in a part that was sort of in between those two worlds, in between sort of the Ladera Heights, which was, you know, sort of where the really successful doctors and lawyers bought houses, and the Bottoms, which is where Dope is set. And I was sort of in a neighborhood kind of in between, kind of middle working class. And so I kind of lived in both of those worlds. It was always interesting, especially as I look back on things. You know, so many of the kids that end up becoming gangsters, drug dealers, whatever, I look back and I think of those kids as just sort of the silly kids that I used to run around the neighborhoods with, riding bikes, skateboards, and playing. But for different reasons, you end up in situations that sometimes, you know, take you in those directions. And there's a line in the movie about these kids have to deal with bad and worse choices. You know, there are no good and bad choices. Oftentimes it's sort of bad and worse.
What's the closest you came to making a choice that could have gotten you into trouble, could have gotten you, you know, imprisoned?
I was on my way to a dance with my friends, and this guy who was a sort of gangster knucklehead offered to give us a ride, and we knew him from the neighborhood, and all my, you know, my friends were like, all right, yeah, cool, let's get in, and I'm like, okay, fine. it is kind of a long walk, so let's jump in this car. And so we got in the car with this guy, and he gets pulled over by the police, and in that moment, as he gets pulled over, I'm sitting there thinking, this is it, you know. this is that moment where I just made a wrong choice, and we've now got pulled over by the police, and I have no idea what they're going to do or who this kid we're riding with actually is.
And what he's carrying.
And what he's carrying or what he's doing, and we're all going to go down, because these, you know, the police aren't going to care that I'm a straight-A student and I have all these ambitions. They're just going to see me as a black kid in the car with a gangster. And so the cop pulled us over, and the kid pulls out his registration, and it turns out this is his mom's car. And as everything, you sort of find out in life that there was so much more posturing than actual real gangster in this kid, because at that moment he became very polite. You know, as the cop came over and well spoken, and the cop kind of let us go and was like, whatever, I forget he had a tail light or something, and let us go. But again, it was just sort of an incident that I know of other people who ended up in that same kind of incident, and they didn't get off that way. They did get arrested, and then that becomes something that's a part of their record forever. And so those are the sort of things, and they're small, you know, and they're innocent.
So the three main characters, among the things they're into is skateboards, manga comics, which are Japanese comics, punk rock, Donald Glover. and these are things that are all criticized for being white. Did you run into that in high school, the things you loved, you were mocked for lacking because they were considered white?
Yeah, in high school, I was into a lot of different stuff. And I did ride skateboards, and now, you know, and I surf. And so it's something that I just kind of have always dealt with. You get that kind of immediate kind of reaction when you're this, you know, 6'3" black guy holding a surfboard, you know, going into a break. You know what I mean? And people kind of look like, oh, okay. Now, you know, that's different. And so so I've always kind of felt that kind of thing, but not wanted to be confined.
So you've released this movie, Dope, a very kind of vibrant comedy. At a time of real tragedy, there's been so much media coverage of shootings of young black men by police, protests of those shootings, the murder of 9 people in the Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina. And I'm wondering about the experience of releasing this just like wonderful comedy at a time when there's like so much tragedy. And there's not just tragedy in the world. But nevertheless, I'm wondering if it's something that you've thought about.
Yeah, it is. And even as I was writing it, it was something I was thinking about as I was writing the script, was right in the middle of the Trayvon Martin incident. And so I was thinking about comedy and how comedy in many ways opens us up to ideas, and really being influenced by Richard Pryor and sort of the way he would use comedy to really speak about larger social issues. And as this film is released and as sort of these incidents have happened and increased and become more visible over the last few years, it just so happens to fit into sort of that conversation that we're having on a larger scale about race, about young black men and young black kids, just about how we are all dealing with each other, the N-word and everything in between that I didn't necessarily set out to do. But I think I was just sort of listening to my environment and felt like comedy was the way to sort of deal with that in a real and personal but also fun way.
Rick Famuyiwa, thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Rick Famuyiwa wrote and directed the new film comedy, Dope. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo by these hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us, floor rush when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He tucks the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why is it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama.